Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Professor Bert Vysotsky of the Jewish Theological Seminary, the creator of the Genesis Project, and a great pioneer in international Jewish-Muslim dialogue. We'll also have visits from our two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gilbert. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. Our fall school season just got underway here in hot Arizona. For some reason, we start school in early August here, and all of our educational systems for adults and kids begin while it's 108 degrees outside with a high probability of nightly monsoons and lightning storms and power outages. Insane. Anyway, as our fall school year begins, I've been thinking about the complexity of trying to explain the influence of Jewish law in our entire tradition. We Jews, whether we are Orthodox, Conservative, Reform, or something else, come originally from a religious culture largely shaped by its process of applying divine law to a very human, fallible, changeable, earthbound population. That means that our heritage is based on the kind of thinking that takes great idealistic proclamations designed to further morality and tries to apply them to mundane daily life with fascinating results. One core ideal of Judaism is to create a society based on justice, which will lead ultimately to peace and goodness. But it is justice that is always the focus, which is embodied in a Torah portion we'll read next Saturday called Shoftim, which means actually judges. More about that later. Importantly for all of us, the practical result of trying to apply high principles to basic common practice is a very intriguing and sometimes bizarre way of thinking about things. When you are Orthodox and believe yourself bound to follow Jewish law, halacha, the way of living that requires adherence to all the many rules about diet, clothing, regular prayers, ritual observances and study, and other things, you sometimes find yourself doing things that don't make much sense. But you do them anyway, because they are part and parcel of the elaborate system of Jewish law that you believe brings about holiness in this world. For example, Orthodox Jewish law forbids work on the day of rest by prohibiting a variety of actions on Shabbat, the Sabbath. Lighting a fire, carrying a heavy object more than a few feet, writing, tearing, elaborate cooking, cleaning, and so on. These laws, quite complex in their interactions with daily life, mean that observant Orthodox Jews do not drive on the Sabbath, or turn on electric lights, or watch TV, or a variety of other normal daily actions they do the rest of the week. However, lest the rules become too restrictive and make life impossible to enjoy Shabbat, which is supposed to be the happiest of weekly days, there are all kinds of ways of making it possible to do what we need to do to make the Sabbath pleasurable. For example, if you're not supposed to carry anything on Shabbat, how do you manage to bring your tallit, your prayer shawl, with you to temple on Saturday morning? The answer is you wear it over your shoulders and walk there. Then it's no longer an item you're carrying, but a garment you are wearing. Problem solved. Which leads to one of my favorite Jewish jokes, which is directly related to this issue. It goes like this. Question: is one permitted to ride in an airplane on the Sabbath? Answer: yes, as long as your seatbelt remains fastened. In this case, it is considered that you are not riding. You are wearing the airplane. I figured that joke needed a laugh track. Please understand that these complex rules are primarily only observed by Orthodox and very traditional conservative Jews, but the thinking that went into creating a system that normal human beings could live with, the pragmatic idealism of Jewish law, has actually come to influence the way all Jews think. While we are Reform Jews and don't follow all the strictures of the Sabbath that our Orthodox family and friends do in my home, my family doesn't go to the mall or go shopping on Shabbat. And although we are Reform, we also keep a kosher home. You know, every non-Orthodox Jew chooses which practices to maintain and how to do them. The reasoning, like my own family's choices about Sabbath observance, Friday night we go to temple, but we might go out before or afterwards to a restaurant for dinner sometimes. We study Torah, but we also watch sports on TV. We'll go on a Shabbat morning hike and have a service and Torah reading during the hike, and so on. These kinds of choices are also influenced by a kind of Talmudic thinking that adapts ideals to pragmatic situations. Maybe that's why Jews of every denomination are so good at law, which is also applying rules to new situations to make things work. It's a kind of intellectual flexibility that seeks to keep in mind and heart the highest principles, while also making it possible for all of us to function in society without losing our integrity. Tricky, but tremendously worthwhile. I just don't think an airplane is really a garment. Well, in other news, it's the first day of the last month of the Jewish year today, the beginning of the month of Elul, which means there are now exactly 28 shopping days until Rosh Hashanah, 5773. To play us in this morning, during a period of the year when we will be preparing for tshuva, the return and repentance required for a good and healthy new year, here's Rabbi Baruch Kohan, my dad, who will join us at my Temple Emmanuel again this year for the holidays, singing his own composition, Tekab Shofar, sound the great shofar of freedom, heralding the arrival of the new year.
Tekab Shofar gadol levevutenu, Vesales lekabes galuyotenu, Vekabetenu yahar.
Take Tika Bishofar Gadol Lecheirutenu Vesanes Vesanes Lekabet Galuyotenu Vekabetzeinu Yachad Mehera Mehera Mehar Bakan Fotaret Leyatzeinu
Tika
Kabetzeinu yachad mehera mehera
Me'ar batan fotaret le'yatzeinu Teka
That was Tekab Shofar, sound the great shofar, the ram's horn, heralding freedom and the gathering together of our people speedily and soon for the coming Jewish High Holy Days in about a month. Traditionally, each day of this month of Elul, we will sound the shofar, awakening our ears and souls to the drama of the coming days of awe and holiness. Our guest this morning is an extraordinary guy, Rabbi and JTS Professor Bert Vysotsky, famous for creating the Genesis Project, which Bill Moyers made into a PBS special 15 years ago, author of a number of wonderful books on Torah and Midrash, and a cutting-edge figure in interfaith work. Meet him when we come back in a few moments on Too Jewish.
Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza. Every once in a while, I gotta do a little bragging. Nah, not about my grandkids. That'd take way more than 60 seconds. I'm gonna brag about our incredible family-sized pizza. Hey, this pizza is huge. I mean, it'll feed 11 or 12 people easy. It's so big that if you take one home, you might have to tilt it to get it in the door. But you know what's even more impressive about the family-sized pizza than its huge dimensions? It's the huge taste. We make this pizza the same way we make all our food at Mama's, with the freshest ingredients available. Vine-ripened tomatoes, fresh dairy cheese, superlatively excellent toppings, and of course, lots of good old-fashioned love. So come on down to Mama's and check out our legendary family-sized pizza or any other of our delicious items. And while you're there, Feel free to ask me about my grandkids. I'll tell you all about them. Now repeat after me. Mama's Pizza.
Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Professor Bert Vysotsky. He's the Appleman Professor of Midrash and Interreligious Studies at the Jewish Theological Seminary, the Conservative Seminary. He joined the faculty immediately upon his rabbinic ordination in 1977. You may know him from the Genesis Project, a wonderful, well, book and TV series with Bill Moyers that aired, is that 15 years ago now?
Yeah, it is a long time ago.
I must be getting old. In the last year, Bert Vysotsky was deeply involved, as he has been for a long time, in interfaith dialogue. He was part of the aftermath of the Park 51 controversy in New York over the Islamic Community Center. He helped to support the Imam, Faisal Abdul Rauf, of Park 51, the original leader, and hosted his wife at a JTS Sukkah. He has been involved in a number of international events, both leading up to the unveiling of the September 11th memorial about a year ago, and on an ongoing basis. Good morning and welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us a little bit about what led to your involvement with the so-called World Trade Center or Ground Zero Mosque last year and over the year before that.
Well, one of the things is that I had been involved with the Imam Faisal Abdul Rauf and his wife Daisy Khan for many years before that. They were very active in the dialogue community among Christians, Jews, and Muslims, and we knew them well as friends of the Jewish community, so it was rather shocking when we saw them attacked as being anti-American, anti-Semitic. In fact, the Imam Faisal travels on behalf of the State Department to Arab countries and Muslim countries around the world, basically to tell them how good it is to be a Muslim in the U.S., so there was a certain amount of irony that they were so attacked.
You know, it's funny, that's sort of how we covered it here on Two Jewish, but intolerance knows no logic. In working to sort of overcome that, talk a little bit about some of the other activities that you've organized and the work that you've done.
Well, one of the reasons I was so involved in the mosque is that I feel that if people can come out and say, we don't want your mosque there, they can just as readily turn and say, we don't want your synagogue there, or we don't want your Sikh temple there, et cetera, et cetera. And I feel that we all have a vested interest in protecting one another and our religious rights, whether we consider that a very narrow Jewish interest or we consider that a First Amendment right. We have to stand shoulder to shoulder to make sure that all Americans can practice their religion as they see fit.
Religious freedom is important for everybody, not just specifically Muslims, Christians, or Jews.
Indeed.
We will talk much more with Bert Vysotsky when we come back on Two Jewish, including discussing his wonderful work, The Genesis of Ethics, which I must confess is one of my favorite books of commentary on Torah of all time, and his involvement in the movie The Prince of Egypt and some other stuff when we come back on Two Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way.
Call 349-0174.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website or download us from there or at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. Here now is our weekly 2012 presidential election campaign Jewish moment. The first non-Protestant ticket ever to appear on a major political party's presidential ballot was determined last week when Mitt Romney picked conservative budget guy Congressman Paul Ryan as his vice presidential choice. Romney, of course, is Mormon, while Ryan is a Catholic. There are also no Protestants on the U.S. Supreme Court at the moment, which is made up of 5 Catholics and 4 Jews. This is a fascinating development in a country in which about 50% of the population identifies as Protestant, 25% Catholic, less than 2% Jewish, and less than 1.5% Mormon. In a sense, while the U.S. remains the most religiously observant of all first world countries, it reflects the fact that many old-time religious biases have substantially faded away. Perhaps it also reflects the fact that Protestants, except for President Obama, have better things to do with their time than run for president or be on the Supreme Court. Or maybe not. Anyway, the Jewish perspective on Paul Ryan depends on whether you are a Democrat or a Republican. While Ryan's budget proposals would reflect a dramatic reduction in the federal government's commitment to poverty relief and medical support for the underprivileged, two key issues that Jews substantially support, his support for Israel, another key issue, has been reliable throughout his tenure in the House. As always, a variety of pundits are weighing in on the eternal question, is he good for the Jews, Paul Ryan? The real answer? He's a congressman running for vice president. It doesn't matter, because ultimately, who cares who the vice president is? Just ask Joe Biden. That was our campaign 2012 Jewish election moment. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbart of the Weintraub Israel Center. Good morning, Guy. Boker Tov.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
You know, you hear very little in the news these days about Hezbollah, which was much in the news 6 years ago during the Lebanon War when Israel went in to squash them and didn't have such great success. Can you explain, because I don't know that our listeners really understand what they are, who they are, who they're allied with, what dangers they pose?
Sure. Hezbollah, well, let's start with the name. What is the name Hezbollah? Hezbollah is basically in Arabic, the party of God. It started basically as a political religious group that comes out of the Shia population in Lebanon. Today, Hezbollah is basically a proxy of Iran. Hezbollah obeys nearly to fully the orders that comes from Iran. It is being sponsored by Iran. It gets its weapons and money from Iran. The United States and Israel recognize Hezbollah as a terrorist group. The European Union, on the other hand, refuses to recognize Hezbollah or list Hezbollah as a terrorist group, as within Lebanon, Hezbollah is also a political party, a very strong political party. So from the European perspective, they refer to Hezbollah as a political group and not as a terrorist group. The European Union refuses to recognize the connection between the political action done by Hezbollah and their terrorist action or guerrilla fighting against Israel, whether it's rocket shootings, whether it was the sponsorship of the latest terrorist attack in Burgos, within the European Union.
Right, in Bulgaria.
In Bulgaria, or even the attack that took place several years ago in Argentina with 85 people killed there.
Or the AMIA attack 18 years ago, right.
Which was also sponsored by Hezbollah. And basically, Hezbollah is probably one of the leading terrorist groups today in the world. And it, as a proxy of Iran, it gives Iran a strong power within Lebanon, which affects the Arab world, and it gives Iran a hand that is very close to Israel from the north, a strategic hand.
Is Hezbollah allied with Syria, in opposition to Syria, with the rebels in Syria working against Assad? Where do they fall in that continuum?
First of all, probably we don't know all the things that are happening on the ground. And as funny as it might sound, probably all the answers are correct. For many years, Hezbollah aligned with Syria, as Syria was the route to get the weapons from Iran. The caravans carrying the weapons for Hezbollah were driving from Iran through Syria, through the Lebanon mountains into the regions that are controlled by Hezbollah. So in order to do that, they needed Assad and Syria to cooperate with them. On the other hand, for many years, Syria was trying to gain control over Lebanon, which is opposing to Hezbollah's agenda of being the ruler
of Lebanon itself.
Of Lebanon.
Right.
So, like anything in the Middle East, things are more complex. You might be polite to someone in his face and then stab him in the back. That's how things work in the Middle East.
Boy, do they ever. Thanks, Guy. We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
Everything you always wanted to know about Judaism, but were afraid to ask. A Taste of Judaism, the largest and most successful outreach program in the country, celebrates its 13th anniversary year with a brand new family class and in a new location. Over 5,000 people have completed the course offered by Temple Emmanuel, Arizona's first congregation. It's your turn now. Taste of Judaism is free and open to all, Jewish or not, and we feed you too. Rabbi Sam Kohan and Rabbi Jason Holtz lead an open, interactive exploration of the history and practice of Judaism in 3 2-hour sessions on spirituality, values, and community. Classes are offered all over the Tucson area, and enrollment is easy. Call 520-327-4501 to sign up. Taste of Judaism is a tremendously successful education and outreach program and an exciting learning opportunity for anyone who is simply curious about Judaism or who wants to deepen their knowledge and gain an understanding of Jewish culture, history, rituals, community, and practice. The classes include delicious tastes of traditional Jewish foods. The sessions are free and open to all, regardless of religious background. But you do need to pre-enroll by calling 520-327-4501. This year, Taste of Judaism is offering both daytime and evening classes in Central, Northwest, and East Tucson, and the very popular Taste of Judaism family class held at the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Adults enjoy a grown-up taste class with rabbis, while kids have their own Taste of Judaism children's program with Jewish stories, crafts, and activities with excellent THA teachers. It's a great learning opportunity for the whole family. There is no fee or obligation, but space is limited and pre-registration is required. Call Bila Anderson at 520-327-4501 for more information and register today.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You've just returned from a remarkable international destination, Camp Ramah in Wisconsin. Wisconsin is certainly a different country than Arizona, but a couple of really interesting international experiences while you were there.
Yeah. First of all, I should probably clarify for your listeners, in case some are not familiar with the Camp Ramah system, that Camp Ramah is the sort of elite summer camp movement of the conservative movement. It was founded in the late 40s, theoretically as a Hebrew-speaking, heavily educational summer camp that didn't focus exclusively on baseball and basketball and swimming, although it incorporated those things. It taught those things in Hebrew, and it had a lot of stuff about Judaism, prayer, history, whatever, and almost from its beginning had a certain percentage of staff members who were from Israel, and that group of staff members were referred to as the Mishlachat, which is Hebrew for like delegation, and they represented Israelis of pretty much any age from immediate post-army at like age 20 or 21 to senior professors and educators and whatever. And I was a camper at Camp Ramah in Wisconsin, which was the first of the Ramah camps in the late 60s, and a staffer in the early to mid 70s. And like any other bureaucracy, you work your way up the staff to increasingly senior supervisory positions. And I will say that now there are Ramah camps in several other countries around the world. There are Ramah programs in Israel. What started off in the 70s as sort of a pioneering program in Wisconsin, which was summer camp for kids with special needs, has now grown very specialized. And the one in Wisconsin is largely for kids with Asperger's, and the one in other camps can be for kids with other sets of disabilities. But, you know, it has changed to some extent over the years. The observations I wanted to share with you were about two different groups of quote-unquote foreigners who were present at camp in significant numbers. And by significant, I mean, you know, 20 or 30 at least out of a camp population which might total 500. So the first is this group that I already mentioned, the Mishlachat, the Israelis present at camp. In the 60s and 70s, interestingly, you could tell Israelis from 100 yards away. They dressed differently, they walked differently, they gestured differently. You knew who was Israeli before you could actually hear them. Now, thanks in part to globalization and the sort of rise of a middle class in Israel and the Americanization of Israel, for better or for worse, you really can't tell until you hear somebody who's potentially Israeli open his or her mouth. And even then, it's not always so sure, because a lot of the people from Israel at camp have at least one American parent. So they speak English with little or no accent in some cases. In other cases, they do have an accent. But, you know, there are Israelis at camp who go summer after summer. There was one young married couple who met each other at Camp Ramah, Wisconsin, even though they're both from Israel. And they now work together in Haifa. And it helps the camp accomplish its goal, which is to get kids to know Israel better and to think about Israel. And in fact, one of the summers is pre-programmed. The summer between 11th and 12th grade, Camp Ramah kids go to Israel if they participate in a Camp Ramah program. They also have an option of going on a pre-Israel thing to Poland, but basically that's the summer for Israel. So more next week about the other international group.
Yeah, and I would add, having been in Israel, of course, many times over the years, you can see that while Israelis are certainly not Americans, in many ways they're more polished, more international, and certainly more conscious of American culture. Fascinating to see that observation. Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. After performing a marriage, the rabbi gives advice to the newlyweds. The first 10 years are always the hardest, says the rabbi. So, how many years have you been married, they ask. 10 years, the rabbi replies. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week's portion from Deuteronomy is called Shoftim, Judges. It establishes a process for the administration of justice. It includes one of the most powerful statements in all religious, philosophical, or ethical tradition. Tzedek, tzedek tirdof. Justice, justice you shall pursue. In the Torah, which has no extra words, no kefel lashon, a repetition of a word means that it has additional import and power. Here, the word for justice, tzedek, is repeated, emphasizing that justice is extraordinarily significant. We must be not only fair in life, but also just, truly just. Even more than that, the Torah teaches us that we must not only be just, but tirdof, pursue justice, chase after it, make it a goal for our own lives and our civilization. It's not enough to act well in a place where justice is not the norm. We must strive to change an unjust situation into a just one. Tzedek, tzedek tirdof. Each of us must pursue true justice. It's easy to understand that for Jews, justice underlies everything good in society. Without justice, there is no peace. Without justice, there's no morality. Without justice, we simply can't trust government or its leaders to act well. Even love is only truly possible where there is respect and a sense of fairness. which are in essence aspects of justice. Be just, God commands. Never accept injustice as a permanent condition in life. Chase justice in your own life. Work for justice in your society. And then good will come. It's a great and holy message in a society like ours in which the pursuit of happiness sometimes seems to be the ultimate goal. But the better pursuit, indeed, the most meaningful real pursuit for any of us is justice. May our actions and our words help to make our society more just in this week and in this last month of the Jewish year. When we come back on To Jewish, our guest, Professor Bert Vysotsky, will explain just what it means for Jews to study Torah in a real, engaged, personal way in today's world. Can it be done? Should it be done? And how is it done? And also, what's going on with Jewish-Muslim dialogue? Find out the answers in a few moments on To Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace. But sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
Everything you always wanted to know about Judaism, but were afraid to ask. A Taste of Judaism, the largest and most successful outreach program in the country, celebrates its 13th anniversary year with a brand new family class and in a new location. Over 5,000 people have completed the course offered by Temple Emmanuel, Arizona's first congregation. It's your turn now. Taste of Judaism is free and open to all, Jewish or not, and we feed you too. Rabbi Sam Kohan and Rabbi Jason Holtz lead an open, interactive exploration of the history and practice of Judaism in 3 2-hour sessions on spirituality, values, and community. Classes are offered all over the Tucson area, and enrollment is easy. Call 520-327-4501 to sign up. Taste of Judaism is a tremendously successful education and outreach program and an exciting learning opportunity for anyone who is simply curious about Judaism or who wants to deepen their knowledge and gain an understanding of Jewish culture, history, rituals, community, and practice. The classes include delicious tastes of traditional Jewish foods. The sessions are free and open to all, regardless of religious background. But you do need to pre-enroll by calling 520-327-4501. This year, Taste of Judaism is offering both daytime and evening classes in Central, Northwest, and East Tucson, and the very popular Taste of Judaism family class held at the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Adults enjoy a grown-up taste class with rabbis, while kids have their own Taste of Judaism children's program with Jewish stories, crafts, and activities with excellent THA teachers. It's a great learning opportunity for the whole family. There is no fee or obligation, but space is limited and pre-registration is required. Call Bila Anderson at 520-327-4501 for more information and register today.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
For the final time in 2012, here is our last Olympic update. New Zealand sailor Joe Alleh won a final Jewish gold medal in the women's 470 class in London, the first Jewish female Kiwi to medal in the Olympics, let alone to win a gold. Fellow New Zealander Nathan Cohen won a gold earlier in the games in double sculls rowing, by the way. Joe Alleh's father is Israeli, her mother a New Zealander, and her victory with partner Polly Powery came in dramatic fashion in the last race of an 11-race competition. Her win takes some of the sting out of Israel's failure to medal at all in the London Olympics, its first miss in the last 24 years of summer games. Aleh, who was bat mitzvahed in Be'er Sheva 14 years ago, whose father now lives in Moshav Yinon near Kiryat Malachi. After parades in New Zealand celebrating this Kiwi sailing champion, she is headed for Israel for her sister's bat mitzvah. I don't know if she'll wear the gold medal there or not. Besides the Kiwis, Jewish medalists in these London Games include Sue Bird of the USA women's basketball team, for the second time for Sue Bird, Allie Reisman with two golds and a bronze in gymnastics, Jessica Fox of Australia with a kayak silver medal, and former Two Jewish guest Jason Lezak with another silver in swimming. Lezak's medal was his eighth Olympic medal, spread out over the past four Olympics, and places him in a tie for third for most medals ever won by a Jewish Olympian. Ahead of him on the list are two more famous swimmers, Mark Spitz, of course, who won seven golds in Munich 40 years ago. That was the record that Michael Phelps broke in Beijing, along with four medals that Spitz won in Mexico City in 68. And the redoubtable Dara Torres, who won 12 medals over the course of an extraordinary career that ran from Los Angeles, her hometown, in the 1984 Games, to Beijing in 2008. In fact, Dara Torres nearly made the Olympic women's team this year again in her mid-40s, an inspiration to all of us older athletes of, you know, lower caliber. The high point of these games, from a Jewish perspective, was surely Allie Reisman becoming the first American gymnast to win a gold in the floor exercises, that is ever, by performing to Hava Nagila. May not quite reach the level of Kerry Strug's dramatic final vault on a sprained ankle in Atlanta in 96, but it was very good. The total of six Jewish athletes taking home eight medals from London, while certainly not bad, pales in comparison to some earlier games, including the 12 athletes who won 18 medals 4 years ago in Beijing, or the record 18 Jewish Olympians who took home 20 medals from Tokyo back in 1964. Overall, Jewish athletes have now won more than 340 medals in Olympic competition. Wouldn't be a bad performance for a country. Israel's performance, or lack of it, caused some hand-wringing nationally in Israel. They'd gotten used to taking home a medal in either judo or a boat sport like windsurfing, sailing, or kayaking. Not this time. Although it's true, one Israeli did bring home a medal from London. Russian Olympic basketball coach David Blatt, who also coaches Maccabi Tel Aviv during real life. His team, Russia, defeated Lithuania 81-77 in the bronze medal game, and Blatt dedicated his medal to Israel afterwards. Often the weirdness of Middle East politics is carried over into the rest of the world. One example is the refusal of almost every country in the world to relocate its embassy to Jerusalem, the capital city of Israel, on the grounds that it might tick off the Arab world. Even though the area of Jerusalem, where all Israeli government ministries are located, has always been Jewish and an integral part of Israel and is acknowledged as such by international law. Anyway, last week, for the first time, parts of the fast-growing Israeli city of Modin appeared on a new European Union list of quote-unquote settlements, putting Modin for the first time alongside places listed as ineligible for tax breaks when their goods are exported to European countries. A small part of Modin, which sits halfway between Jerusalem and Tel Aviv and is a bedroom community serving both cities and an increasingly desirable place to live in Israel, a small part of Modin lies inside a no-man's land buffer zone that existed between Israel and the Jordanians between 1948 and 1967. In practical terms, the city's inclusion on the list will only affect three small zip codes within Maccabim, a posh neighborhood on Modin's eastern edge. Since that part of Maccabim is not recognized by the EU as Israel, products exported from there would fall outside the parameters of a free trade agreement known as the EU-Israeli Association Agreement. Well, this ridiculous change was made due to pressure on the European Commission from the European Parliament. The Israeli Foreign Ministry responded last week by saying that the EU list ignored reality. There's not the slightest doubt that Modin and Maccabim and Reut localities are an integral part of Israel and their future is not in question. The EU ignores reality when it extends the domain of conflict to places and issues that do not belong there. For the other locations mentioned on the EU list, the European approach, though not new, is not acceptable to Israel. It is being addressed through ongoing diplomatic engagement. In practical terms, that means any goods produced in these three neighborhoods of Modin will be at a competitive tax disadvantage when they are brought to Europe to sell. Another area considered no man's land is located between the eastern and western parts of Jerusalem, other locations listed by the EU as not being part of Israel. My, they get to make that decision, huh? Are the Golan Heights, the West Bank, and all of East Jerusalem, including the Jewish quarter.
Lord, get me high. get me high, get me high. Lord, get me high, get me higher. Lord, get me high, get me high, get me high. Lord, get me high, get me higher.
There's a new hit show out in New York. It'll get to Broadway later this year. It's based on the life of the legendary rabbi, singer, composer, storyteller, author, and charismatic figure, Rabbi Shlomo Carlebach. The new show, titled Soul Doctor, The Journey of a Rockstar Rabbi, is the first new Jewish musical hit in decades. As a cultural phenomenon in the 60s music scene, Shlomo Carlebach's songs grew wildly popular. He performed on stage with Bob Dylan, Joni Mitchell, Jerry Garcia, Pete Seeger, The Grateful Dead, and Nina Simone, among others. He played venues from Carnegie Hall to hippie coffee houses, from prisons to ashrams. He even performed spontaneous midnight concerts under New York City's West Side Highway for the local homeless, many of whom he knew by name. Shlomo Carlebach died suddenly in 1994 when his heart failed on an airplane at LaGuardia. His annual yard site triggers memorial concerts around the world. He is in a category all his own. His music is now used by Reform, Reconstructionist, Conservative, Gay and Lesbian, Orthodox, and Hasidic communities, including Carlebach Shuls, as they're called, synagogues in New York and Jerusalem, and maybe elsewhere. Crossover Jewish reggae sensation Matisyahu, a former guest of Two Jewish, calls himself a Bob Marley Shlomo Carlebach fusion. Pope John Paul II used Carlebach's composition Brothers and Friends, Laman Achai V'Re'oi, to open his last Mass at Giants Stadium when he was in New Jersey. The new show traces Carlebach's journey into the countercultural world of the 50s and 60s, his heart-centered teachings and songs of boundless love and joy, which touched hippies and dropouts and many others. Carlebach's daughter Neshama, a former guest of Two Jewish, is working with the show's creator, playwright Daniel Wise of Rent fame, on the play. Looks like we'll have to go to New York to see it soon. If you haven't seen Shlomo Carlebach in action in your life, check out the many YouTube cuts for him. I saw him live twice, once as a child in L.A., and then in 1992 in Jerusalem when I was a rabbinical student. He was amazing at bringing everybody present into his melodies and energy. Leon Morris, a classmate and I, he's now a rabbi in New York, editing the new Reform High Holy Day prayer book, attended a Saturday night concert by Carlebach in the basement of a Jerusalem hotel. He sang for hours without a break, telling an occasional heartfelt story. He was oddly magnetic, kind of the Jewish version of the Grateful Dead or Fish, only even before the Grateful Dead, with whom he performed, or Fish. And that's the news of Jews around the world. We're delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Bert Vysotsky. He's the Appleman Professor of Midrash and Interreligious Studies at the Jewish Theological Seminary. How does that fit on a business card, by the way?
Well, I like to joke that JTS gives me longer titles in lieu of salary, but I'm happy.
That's probably
that
not entirely a joke, is it?
No, but I'm happy that the Appleman's endowed a chair. I'm exceptionally happy that I can earn a living actually studying Midrash, rabbinic narrative, and relating that to how the works of the Church Fathers and how Islamic works also interpret the stories that we all know and love from Scripture.
I should add that Dr. Vysotsky is also the Lewis Stein Director of the Finkelstein Institute for Religious and Social Studies at Jewish Theological Seminary. He has been Associate and Acting Dean of the Graduate School there, founding Rabbi of the Egalitarian Worship Service at JTS's Women's League Seminary Synagogue, has degrees from University of Illinois Chicago, from Harvard and JTS, has been a visiting faculty member at Oxford, Cambridge, and Princeton. How did you miss the Sorbonne? I'm just curious.
My French just really isn't up to snuff.
Maybe you could have taught in Aramaic and solved the problem. With Bill Moyers, Bert Vysotsky developed 10 hours of TV for PBS, their collaboration, which many of you may remember, called Genesis, A Living Conversation, started in 1996, and he consulted on the Prince of Egypt. Tell us a little bit about, in brief, how would you describe Midrash to a contemporary audience?
I think Midrash is two things. On one hand, it's how
the rabbis, the Jewish community, read scripture. If you will, if you open a Torah scroll, there's lots of black ink. We try to read the white spaces around it and understand what's missing in the text, what needs to be resolved in the text, what are problems in the text, what needs to be made contemporary in the text. The other part of Midrash is rabbinic story, narratives, tales of the sages. I joke about it that we all gossip about our rabbis, but if you wait 500 years, well, then it's sacred literature.
Will someday Prince of Egypt be sacred literature then?
Well, I think in an odd way, it already has become sacred literature. There is an entire generation of adults and children who saw the film Prince of Egypt, and that for them is their story of the Exodus, much as the old movie, the Charlton Heston movie, The Ten Commandments, was for an older generation. It becomes the iconic vision of how it really happened.
Is it better to have popular depictions out there? Does that encourage people to study seriously, or does that simply replace other ideas?
I think both. Jeffrey Katzenberg was very careful to say, and it really says it right at the front of the movie, this is a story about the Exodus. We encourage you to study the Bible. The truth of the matter is, I know I've used it, and a lot of my colleagues have used that film and an animated feature in school settings and brought kids back to the Bible story to see what's different, what's the same, how to do Midrash, how to read a contemporary retelling of an ancient tale.
I've done that myself, of course. Another multimedia experience, the Genesis Project or Genesis Living Conversation. Your work with Bo Moyers helped pioneer a whole bunch of Genesis projects around the country. Talk about how that evolved. That's 15 years now, 16 years.
It's a long time ago, and it was a wonderful, wonderful experience. I felt like a kid in a candy store, except it was an intellectual experience. Here at the Jewish Theological Seminary, for the 5 years before Bill Moyers called me, I was running a writers group of some very well-known writers, people like Cynthia Ozick and the like, and we were reading Genesis together because I was fascinated to see how really experienced writers might read a text and whether they might create their own midrash. As it turned out, they were very, very good readers, and it was so much fun and so exciting, and it was interreligious among the writers, that they wrote a couple of articles about the group in the New York Times. When we finished Genesis after 5 years, there was one last article in the New York Times, and a couple of weeks later, Bill Moyers called me and said, I've been looking for a way to do Bible study, interreligious, neutral, and put it on public television. Are you game? And I was more than game. We did 10 hours of television, 8 different discussants in every session, and we covered all the major stories in Genesis. And as you said, around that series, over 1 million people signed up to do interfaith study groups on the Bible.
I have a more painful question for you. The conservative movement, you're teaching at Jewish Theological Seminary. By the way, you are the first rabbi I have ever talked to who is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations.
But in fact, I'm not the only rabbi who's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. And obviously, in our small little world, and particularly since we're not only concerned about America, but also Israel, it's good to be well-educated in foreign relations. But that wasn't your question.
No, it wasn't. I'm sorry. I digress. Conservative movement has gone through some paroxysms in recent years. It's lost numbers. It's lost influence. Somehow, it seems to me that the best works of popular and sometimes scholarly Jewish work is coming from the faculty of the conservative movement, particularly JTS, like your own work. That's not the direction it seems American Judaism is going. Having grown up in a conservative shul primarily, I speak from some inside knowledge, member of the Canon's Assembly and the Reform Rabbi. But that's limited. From your perspective, what do you see happening with the conservative movement?
Well, I actually think we're alive and well. By and large, and this is true of the mainline Protestant churches, a lot of organized religion in America is becoming less and less organized, a little bit more like, you know, Will Rogers saying he didn't belong to an organized political party.
He was a
Democrat.
Right?
Well, I'm a conservative Jew. Our numbers are shrinking a bit, but not wildly. They say in America that the fastest growing religious affiliation are the nuns. That's N-O-N-E. And I think that our movement is suffering as many movements are. That said, what you said is true. Some of the most exciting things happening in the Jewish world are coming out of the Jewish Theological Seminary. Many of the independent minyanim, the independent synagogue groups, many of the independent study circles are run by our people. And we're very proud of that. We think that we are going to keep Judaism alive and well. Our newest chancellor, he's been around 5-6 years now, Arnie Eisen, I think has an incredible vision for the future. But like all Jewish institutions in America, right now we're still suffering because of the recession.
Your own work, as primarily a midrashist, has certainly gone a variety of different directions, including some political ones. How do you see, what's the common thread?
I think the common thread of all my work is my sense of Jewish identity and my desire to engage the Jewish community here and abroad and to engage it in ways that keep it as a light to the nations, as a beacon in the international and local American scene.
Do you have any idea what the next direction will be?
The next direction? Golly. I'm looking forward to a sabbatical in the spring of 2014, and I may be able to travel that semester. I think I will continue doing interreligious dialogue work. I think that's essential to our well-being and the health of this country and the Jewish community. I would like to be able to engage more with the State of Israel and make sure that they're on a path to peace. And I would hope to continue writing both my, if you'll forgive the expression, hardcore scholarly work, that's, work with lots of footnotes that only 12 people read,
right,
and then the so-called popular Judaica, which more than 12 people read, and even my relatives will read.
That's truly, truly impressive. A final political question. You are the national co-chair of Rabbis for Obama 2012. How does you're on the J Street National Advisory Council. That's politically active for the conservative movement, certainly. How is that received, and how does that work with your scholarly stuff?
I think all citizens should be active in politics. I think if you care about something, then you have to be willing to be political about it. I care very much about the future of this country and the future of Israel, and so I am involved. How is it received? Well, it's received, I think, generally well. I'm in an institution like any academic institution that gives me academic freedom to pursue the things I think that are important and to speak about what I think is important to speak about. So I have been very pro-President Obama. I think he's done good things for this country and great things for Israel. And I have been very active on an almost separate venue in trying to make sure that Israel can make peace as soon as possible. Whether it's J Street or APEC, we all want Israel to be at peace with their neighbors and to flourish. And so I'm just a good old-fashioned Zionist, as far as I'm concerned.
I want to thank Bert Visotsky for a great visit here on Too Jewish. You can find out about his books, well, pretty much anywhere online, including Sage Tales, Wisdom and Wonder from the Rabbis of the Talmud, A Delightful Compendium of Consolation, his historical novel, and The Genesis of Ethics. Thanks, Bert, for a great visit.
Thank you very much for having me.
When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be Jay Sanderson, the president and CEO of the Los Angeles Jewish Federation, an entrepreneur who is shaking up the Federation world. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or our TooJewishRadio.com website and like us on Facebook. Our playout this morning comes from the Beth Abraham Youth Chorale, conducted by cantor Sholom Caleb, Shomer Yisrael, from the liturgy for the period of Slichot prayers in this month, in preparation for the Jewish High Holy Days. My friends, have a Chodesh Tov, a good month, a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.